Well, go ahead and grab your Bibles if you have them and turn with me to the book of Ecclesiastes. And we'll once again return to chapter 9 this morning. Last time we were in this book together, we spent our time in verses 1 through 10 of this chapter, where basically Solomon just once again reminded us of the absolute brevity or shortness of life. And so his whole point was nothing less than to simply say that you and I can go crazy obsessing over things like our finances, or you can worry about your status or wonder whether or not you're actually going to reach some kind of goal. But he just said that the longer that you think on those things and the more that you actually spend your time calculating and ordering your life to either become something or just simply attain something, the reality is the more that you actually lose. And the reason for that is because a person can spend their whole life trying to reach some kind of accomplishment or status or even attain some kind of standard for living. But then before they know it, and simply because it's the reality of what it means to live a life under the sun, is that right when you think you have it, or right when you think you're about to reach the pinnacle of life, and so all that you wanted and all that you saved and all that you worked to achieve is finally within your reach, the irony of a life lived under the sun is that life is just about over. And so what Solomon said, and his whole point with these first 10 verses, was to do nothing more than simply remind us that life is fleeting, that your days are incredibly short. And so the mark of a wise person is not only that they're able to recognize such things, but actually live and then order their life in light of such things. And so he just exhorted us in verses 7 through 10 to stop worrying. That is, to stop fretting, to stop trying to control the things which at the end of the day you have no ability to control, and instead learn to enjoy life. And so he just said that the design of God for your life, especially in light of its ever-fleeting reality, is to learn that joy comes not from the big accomplishments of life, but in the details of everyday life, which we often take for granted. And so his conclusion there in verse 10 was to simply say, so pursue these things with all of your might. Pursue them with a kind of energy and vigor, because the days are short, your life is fleeting, and God has appointed a time and end for everyone. And so he just said, pursue life now. Pursue it fully. Pursue it while you can. Pursue it with an understanding that recognizes that life is always shorter than any of us are ever wanting to talk about. And so what Solomon's going to do now, really through the rest of the book, that is through chapters 10, 11, and 12, is really nothing more than just attempt to sort of build us up a little bit. He is still going to be incredibly realistic, but he is going to show us a little bit more of his hopeful side. And so what he's actually going to do is spend the majority of time throughout these next few chapters on how to really live this life and live it well. But before he gets there, and true to Solomon, he is going to give us one last reminder this morning about the difficult nature of this life, which is the rest of chapter 9. And I think the reason that he does this is because while it is so easy to buy into a certain worldview and even acknowledge as Christians a certain way that we ought to approach this life, the thing that we cannot forget, because it's the thing that he's been saying on repeat for almost 9 chapters, is that no matter what you believe or what you actually believe about this world, the reality for all of us is there is no such thing as a guarantee. Even for the Christian, the truth of our experience is that a life lived under the sun is, as he's been saying, broken, twisted, and fractured. And so since that's the case, and since that's our reality, the truth of the matter is that there's always going to be difficulty. There's always going to be hardship. There's always going to be this ever-present reality of a constant frustration, no matter what we come to know or believe as truth. And so before he gets into showing us the nature of how to pursue a life that's lived well, this is what he's going to try and remind us of yet one more time this morning. So let's go ahead and read it, and then we'll, Lord willing, work through it. So it's chapter 9, and we'll be in verses 11 through 18, which is the rest of the chapter. Solomon writes, "And again I saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, and the battle is not to the warriors, and neither is bread to the wise, nor wealth to the discerning, nor favor to men of ability. For time and chance overtake them all. Moreover, man does not know his time, like a fish caught in a treacherous net and birds trapped in a snare, so the sons of men are ensnared at an evil time, when it suddenly falls on them. Also, this I came to see as wisdom under the sun, and it impressed me. There was a small city with few men in it, and a great king came to it, surrounded it, and constructed large siege works against it. But there was found in it a poor wise man, and he delivered the city by his wisdom. Yet no one remembered that poor man. And so I said, wisdom is better than strength, but the wisdom of the poor man is despised, and his words are not heeded. The words of the wise heard in quietness are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good." Well, he begins here in verse 11 with a phrase that we've seen him use now a few times throughout this book, and it is this phrase here of, "And again I turned to see," or "again I saw under the sun." Now, this idea of him turning to yet once again see something is really just Solomon's way of saying that it's hard for him to just sort of let something go. And what I mean by that is he's already made the observation and he's already drawn some conclusions on this particular topic, but for some reason he just feels the need to come back to it. In other words, he's just describing something that's incredibly familiar to both you and me. What he's describing here is nothing less than that experience of that while we know that something is true, and that while we've come to expect much of this world as broken and twisted, and while we'll even talk to one another and remind one another about how this existence has been fractured by sin and crippled with the reality of hell, there's still just a sense in that while it's so easy to affirm that truth in theory, there's no amount of affirming that'll actually make the experience of hell any less frustrating. So think about the last time that something didn't go well for you or didn't go your way. Think about the last time that you perhaps experienced an injustice, even if it was small. Or maybe this past week when something at work or perhaps in the home made you so angry, and maybe even rightfully so. While you and I can sit here and talk about or even hear about how all of these things are the result of sin and can then gather into community groups and talk about how we shouldn't be surprised by this reality, the truth of the matter, and you and I both know this to be true, is that none of that actually nullifies or numbs the force of what it feels like when Havel once again comes for us. And so there's just this sense for Solomon, where no matter how much he observes or concludes, or even how much wisdom he's able to discover, the ever-present reality of a Havel means there will always be an ever-present reality of frustration. And so he just begins here by saying, "And again I turn to see again something under the sun." And it's just going to be some of the same stuff that he's already talked about. So notice what he sees again starting in verse 11. He states, "And again I saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, and the battle is not to the warriors, and neither is bread to the wise, nor wealth to the discerning, nor favor to men of ability." Now, what he's observing here are just those basic areas of what you and I, or what Solomon's original readers would simply call just everyday life. And so notice, whether it's in the sports arena or even in something like battle, the way that things are supposed to be in the right and proper order to this life is that everyone knows that the victory should always go to the fastest, strongest, and most well-trained, right? But the reality of Havel and the reality of a life lived under the sun is that sometimes there's just these incredible upsets, aren't there? Why is it that you can train with the best and be incredibly disciplined in your diet, but where you do all the right stretches and get all the right amount of sleep, but then when race day comes and the moment for which you've been working and waiting finally arrives, your body just decides that it's going to cramp up? And so someone not even close to your speed takes the victory. Now, this isn't a profound observation of Solomon, but it is an observation about the backwards stuff of life. It's just the everyday twisted stuff that you and I know just ought not to be. It's the kind of thing that when all is said and done is the kind of thing that's incredibly disappointing and never anything less than frustrating. Or why is it, as Solomon observes here, that in a world of both wisdom and folly, where the wise should prosper and the fool should suffer, do the lazy, slothful, and proud go prosperous, all the while those who are wise, hardworking, and humble just can't seem to get ahead? Or as he says here, maybe in some places of the world, just get some bread. Solomon sees and observes that this kind of reality in which the fool gets gain while the wise lose out is something for which no matter who you are, whether you're a wise or a foolish person, know that this is not the way it's supposed to be. You know it in your mind, you know it in your soul, you know that this life is backwards and filled with upsets. And so why is it that while we live in a world of fixed laws, where things like gravity always works and the sun always rises and the seasons always stay in their proper order, that when it comes to humanity, you and I both know that for some reason or another, there is no security, there is no assurance, there is no fixed system in which any kind of guarantee can actually be promised to you? This is the Havel of life, and for Solomon, regardless of what we know or what we believe, something which will always frustrate you. And you know this. But notice the ultimate cause of this frustration, or at least what Solomon observes to be a major player into this frustration. So he states in verse 11 that life is backwards, that this life is broken. It is not what the human soul knows that it ought to be, but the reason for that, end of the verse, is because of these things called time and chance. And these are things which, as he says here, overtake all of us. Now, what you have to understand about this argument is that Solomon's not invoking some kind of evolutionary understanding of time or chance. For we already saw in chapter 3 that every time and season sits under the sovereign control and in providence of God. Furthermore, in verse 1 of this chapter, Solomon just got done acknowledging that every deed and even every action of man, whether it be good or evil, are ultimately resting, as he states, within the hand of God. And so whether it's something that a person does or something which happens to a person, all of those things, whether they be something good or evil, are ultimately controlled, ordered, and arranged by a sovereign creator. And so what Solomon is saying here in the use of these words is just giving a statement about life, but it's a statement of life from a perspective that's under the sun. In other words, it's speaking of life from a position of finitude, from a position that doesn't know what's to come, that doesn't have all of the answers. In other words, it's a perspective of life that's from something other than God's perspective. Really, it's speaking about the fact that you and I rarely ever know what's to come. And so while you might have your day all planned out and know exactly what you're going to do for lunch, or you might know what's on the schedule for this week, or even possess the most brilliant five-year plan where you have plotted for yourself the greatest prosperity and success, the fact of the matter is that at the end of the day, all of those things are nothing more than a series of hopeful thoughts, dreams, and ideas, aren't they? They're nothing more than ideas of what we want, of what we think will happen. Honestly, most of the time, what we assume is going to happen. But the reality of life, and the point of Solomon here, is that what makes life so incredibly complicated and so unbelievably frustrating is that from an under the sun and a finite perspective, these realities of time and chance are these things which have this way of so absolutely devastating all of your plans, all of your dreams, every single one of those desires, big or small, which we've come to expect. Or maybe hoping. Hence one of the real reasons behind our frustrations. I think what makes life so incredibly difficult is that we are just these creatures of plan, aren't we? It's what it means to not be God. And so in a world that has these fixed laws and predetermined regulations, which God has put into place, there's just a certain level of expectation that's been created. And so what makes life hard and so often brings the frustration is the fact that we all experience constantly the reality of unmet expectation. Hence the anxiety and worry and even anger. We built up in our minds these things that we've determined are going to be, but then we have no ability to actually bring them about. And so we just kick and fight and get angry. But this, for Solomon, is exactly what it means to live a life under the sun. No matter how much frustration might come your way, you still can't negotiate with it. You can't have a discussion. It is a reality that's completely out of your control, and it is the essence of Havel. We are all creatures of time and chance, and so despite your will and despite your desires, you have no ability to be sovereign. And this is what Solomon sees. But notice what he says next, verse 12. And he points something out here that not only makes the experience of Havel something frustrating, but also something that's worthy to Solomon's mind of actually being called evil. So notice what he says, verse 12. He states, "Moreover, man does not know his time. Like fish caught in a treacherous net and birds trapped in a snare, so the sons of men are ensnared at an evil time, at a time when it suddenly falls on them." So he just begins here by affirming that the realities of time and chance are something which the finite man has no ability to know, which is precisely why things are so frustrating. The Havel is often uncontrollable and rarely ever able to be predicted. But beyond its uncontrollability and unpredictability, what makes Havel frustrating and makes it all the more difficult to handle is the fact that the hardships of life and the brokenness of life are the kinds of things which almost always seem to come so suddenly. And so to illustrate that reality, he points here to the picture of a fish just minding its own business. It's simply swimming along and just doing what God has created it to do, and then before it even has the ability to negotiate its circumstance, it's already been caught. And notice, he uses the term treacherous, or ra'ah, literally evil. Translated quite literally, it could read like a fish possessed by a stronghold of evil. They're harsh words. It's the idea here of trapping to be destroyed, like we see with the bird. And so if you think he's overstating the case here, imagine something like being a person who is in one of the buildings on 9/11. Or think about the suddenness and devastation that something like just one drunk driver can bring to an entire family and completely devastated. And maybe you're not the one who gets struck. Maybe you're the mom or dad who gets the phone call. There's nothing that prepares you to receive that kind of news or teaches you how to deal with the sudden shock of that kind of reality. Or maybe it's not something so deadly, although that's the picture that Solomon's giving. Maybe it's the sudden news that you no longer have a job. Or you walk out like me to discover that your car is number 4 in a 5-car pileup while legally parked in front of your home. And of course, they have no insurance. What makes the twisted things of life and the broken things of life so difficult to embrace is always the absolute suddenness with which they often present themselves. The truth of the matter is that none of us in this room are actually expecting to get some kind of phone call today, are we? Although we'll all be the first to acknowledge that it could come. None of us are actively preparing our minds and emotions for something to go wrong this afternoon. But the meaning of the passage here is that these things of Cavell come as time and chance determine that they'll come. And the point we all know, and the point of Solomon, is that no amount of recognizing that truth or even agreeing that that's a reality actually makes the experience of Havel any less difficult to handle when the trap of Havel decides to snap. And so while we're all looking for a quick fix and for some kind of formula to resolve the many frustrations or at least numb us to the realities of Havel, notice Solomon doesn't actually give us any kind of command or counsel. He simply makes the observation, he acknowledges that this is a reality, and then just sort of leaves us hanging. Which is actually a commentary on the permanency of our situation. And so Solomon here, being who he is, observes that this is sometimes a devastating reality. It's something which comes to every person. It's inescapable. It's a guarantee that none of us want. And due to its suddenness and often unpredictability, it is an experience that in the moment is never anything easy to navigate. And so if it's not something that's crippling, it is still something never anything less than frustrating. And Solomon knows this. So look at where he goes next in verses 13 through 17. And here he just sort of shoots off into this story or parable, and it's not completely unrelated, although it sort of seems like it. He writes, "Also, this I came to see as wisdom under the sun, and it impressed me," or something that was great and impressed itself upon me. "There was a small city with few men in it, and a great king who came to it, surrounded it, and constructed large siege works against it. But there was found in it a poor wise man, and he delivered the city by his wisdom. Yet no one remembered that poor man. And so I said, wisdom is better than strength, but the wisdom of the poor man is despised, and his words are not heeded." Now, this is a story that was most likely made up by Solomon, but it is a story designed to teach us something about the nature of wisdom. Now, many have speculated that this was an event that perhaps happened to Solomon himself, and so there are far too many pages in the commentaries spent trying to figure out to which event in history this is referring. But when all is said and done, there is no real consensus, and most of them, in one way or another, acknowledge that it's simply a picture that Solomon's using to support a greater idea. And so the point here, as I mentioned, is without a doubt to teach us something about the nature of possessing wisdom. And so as you just read through this story, you'll notice that the language of small and few and poor are all attached with this poor wise man in one way or another, the wise man in this city. And so when it comes to the king who is laying down his siege work, the words attached with him are things like great and large and surrounding. And so what you have here is just a clear literary contrast. These were the days of tribal warfare, and so this is the kind of story that would have resonated with Solomon's hearers. And so what you have here is just the typical story of a small town that's overtaken by a powerful king with all of his evil intentions, and then here arises this small sort of underdog of a hero. Now, Solomon's pretty intentional here about linking this wise deliverer with poverty, or at least with being poor. And the reason for that is because he's actually trying to deconstruct the Jewish presupposition that wisdom is somehow always connected with power and wealth and prosperity. But beyond that, the actual point of the story is to show that while wisdom does sometimes bring good things to people and situations, the reality is that it's still met with an enormous amount of ingratitude. And so as one commentator actually states about this story, he says, "The point of the parable is not a moral tale to show what people should do, but rather it's a cautionary tale to show what people are like. If we're to identify with anybody, it is with the poor wise man. Not as though we should fancy ourselves as such, but simply that, sadly enough, we should learn not to count on anything as fleeting as public gratitude." Now, I do think that's a pretty good summary of Solomon's point here, but where it does seem to fall short, in my view, is that it actually tends to state Solomon's point in rather positive terms. In other words, he's basically just saying that we shouldn't hold our breath for some kind of praise or recognition. And while there is truth to that, notice how Solomon actually talks about wisdom here in verse 17. He states, "So I said that wisdom is better than strength." So there is some kind of good that wisdom typically brings. Wisdom is just better than folly. There's just this reality in which wisdom, generally speaking, does tend to prosper people, whereas foolish people usually tend to destroy themselves. But notice what he then says. He states, "But the wisdom of the poor man is actually despised." In other words, this is more than mere ingratitude or thanklessness. The point of Solomon here, if you're reading this rightly, is that wisdom actually has this way of producing not merely ingratitude, but actually a kind of hatred. That is, a kind of reviling and even despising that comes from the mind and mouth of fools. Ingratitude is one of those things, keeping in theme here, that is incredibly frustrating. The self-entitled mindset that's pervaded our culture and the posture that everyone ought to be doing something for you is not only upside down to the very order of God's creation and therefore havel, but also just maddening because it always typically is demanded from ingrates. That is, from those who are ungrateful. But beyond that, and truer to the point here, think about the last time that you tried to speak truth or wisdom into a situation and a person just wasn't going to have it. Maybe it was a neighbor or coworker, maybe it was one of your family members, or maybe it was even one of your children. And so the moment that you tried to speak truth or wisdom for their good, or maybe even for the benefit of their soul, it was not only responded to with incredible arrogance, or that they somehow knew better, but think about the last time when your words or counsel were just outright rejected from a heart of anger. And I'm not talking about a simple disagreement or difference of opinion or something like that, but I'm talking about when you see somebody on a certain path and you're watching their trajectory and you're seeing their decision-making. You see all the things that are beginning to distract them from a life of wisdom in a pursuit of that which is good and right and pure. Think about even within the church. The people you perhaps come and go over the years, and not just because they developed a different conviction or something like that, but because they started to head down a path that had its end in destruction. And so the moment that they were confronted, or the moment that someone tried to speak, or that moment where perhaps you resolved in your mind where the faithful words you were about to speak were either going to win this person or completely harden them, and so you knew you were about to lose a friend. You ever been there? But in faith, you chose to speak and perhaps address the issue. But then true to this life and true to the nature of sin and pride, you found that your words of truth and wisdom were not merely ignored, but actually hated. Where the person actually despised the words coming out of your mouth. What I think is important to know about wisdom, and the point that Solomon is trying to draw out here, is that more often than not, the simple words of truth, wisdom, and the soundness of counsel are often the kinds of words that tend to just be rejected and even hated. And while I think that's something that we all have perhaps experienced, I think it's something that we often forget. Wisdom should be the kind of words that are most sought after. The words that are most loved, the words that are most given to praise. But in a world that's twisted, in a world that's completely broken and upside down, this is the experience of the wise living in a world of folly. And so the implication of Solomon here is that we just ought not be surprised by this kind of thing. It might be an experience that's frustrating, but it should never be an experience that's shocking to you. The reality is you shouldn't actually expect people are going to listen to words of wisdom. In fact, the truer that your words are, probably the more anger they're actually going to incite. As you speak with your neighbors and coworkers, as you talk with your children and family members, do not be surprised by eye rolls, but certainly do not be shocked at the visceral response that some might have. Especially when it comes to the topic of the gospel. If you're just trying to speak into somebody's life because you think that they should be doing something different, or that they're not doing something the way that you should do it or would do it, whether you're right or wrong, you're probably always going to get rejected. We all know people who like to meddle, people who like to stick their opinion in as if their opinion is in some way truer, because in their mind, somehow their way is the only way. But when it comes to the person of Christ, and when it comes to the issues of sin and salvation, the one area as a Christian where you do not have the right not to ever speak, do not expect that you'll actually find a welcomed reception. I like what Sinclair Ferguson said about this section. He said, "Whose name most naturally comes to mind when we hear of a poor man full of wisdom who becomes a savior, but whose life and teaching have been neglected and rejected? Instinctively, we should think of our Lord." And in light of that thought, all of a sudden, any ingratitude, or more accurately, hatred, which has ever frustrated us, just pales into insignificance. It is precisely the Christian, That is, the one seeking to follow their model and Lord, who is the kind of person whose words will most be rejected. Was it not Jesus Christ, who was the very embodiment of God's wisdom itself, who was not only despised, but actually killed? What we must understand is that in a world of sin and folly, the Christian life is not a life designed ever to receive praise under the sun. The reality and even the promise of Christ himself is that anytime you speak truth as it's been shaped and formed by the Bible, is that there will always be a mass majority of people in this world who will actually hate what you say. And this is something that every Christian must embrace, especially living in a country headed in a direction as ours. When you talk to your neighbor or your children about the things of God and call them to repentance and plead with them to embrace the wisdom of the gospel, do not be surprised when they reject it. Do not be shocked when they look at you and say, "I do not want it. In fact, I hate it." This is the natural order of folly in a broken, fallen world. It is the essence of what it means to be trapped and blinded in a system of sin and delusion and futility under the sun. In fact, look at how this folly often works itself out in this world. Verse 17. Not only does it reject wisdom, but it actually then declares its folly in the streets. He writes, "The words of the wise heard in quietness are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good." There's just a kind of reality in which this world, and for some reason or another, is just so often drawn to the loudest personality. Do you know what I'm talking about? And so what Solomon is saying here is that you can be right and true and wise and even correct, but there will always be words, thoughts, and ideas that are louder, prouder, and in the end, deadly. But regardless of the disaster that foolish ideas always create, they'll still become accepted and championed by a broken, fallen, foolish world. The nature of what it means to live in a crooked world is that people, and you see this all throughout history, and especially within the last 60 years or so in our country, is that people, regardless of the topic, always seem to flock to those who are most vocal about their agenda. And what I find so interesting about this little proverb is notice what he says here at the end. He says that sometimes an entire movement it really only takes the voice of one person who decides to shout, of one who decides that they're going to revolt. And then true to sinful humanity, the words of the fool always stir up passion in the heart of another fool. And so before you know it, they hop on board, and what you have is a mob of folly just perpetuating more folly. And so a message or agenda that had at one time seemed so absurd and foolish or maybe even deplorable all of a sudden becomes a standard for truth and what appears to be the right and wise thing to do. Think about some of the social movements that have taken place just within the past 10 years in our country. Think about what's praised on television or within the media. More than that, think about the kinds of things that are actually becoming shamed and even criticized if you actually decide you're going to talk about them in public. And so while Solomon is writing to his son here to just sort of warn him against the nature of groupthink and how quickly even just one voice can overthrow or persuade even a just king, and actually that's exactly what happened to his son Rehoboam. You can read about that in 2 Chronicles chapter 10. But the meaning behind the proverb here has such an enormous range of implication. And so since that's the case, I just want to try and draw your attention here to just two things that I think we can observe from Solomon's statement. Number one, the first is that there's just always going to be appeal and even an allure to a new voice and a fresh voice, even if it's not wisdom or truth. And so while this is such an important warning to any person, I think it's especially important for a Christian parent. I think about this stuff now more because I have one. But I couldn't help but consider the reality that if you think that sound reason and the fact that your child always comes back to your home at the end of the day is somehow going to trump the agendas and voices of this world, despite the fact that their entire day has just been spent having their desires and reasons all shaped and formed, even passively, by a constant stream of things like music and television and advertisement and video games and a now overtly anti-Christian school system and friends and marketing and sports and government, and I have about 10 more of these, then I say this with nothing but love, because Solomon says this, and I have absolutely nothing to gain from this. Then you're a fool. You are a fool. Because while we live in an existence where there is a constant competition of voices in multiple areas of life, the reality for Solomon, according to verse 18, is that all that it takes to corrupt and destroy something good and right and beautiful, which might even be the soul of your child, is just one. It takes just one voice to plant a seed. Or just one voice to awaken the folly that already resides within the heart of any sinner. And so while God is absolutely sovereign in saving a person, he's also absolutely sovereign in appointing the means through which that salvation not only comes, but is also protected. I think that sometimes we're just so good at using theology to just escape theology. There is a very good reason for why in the parable of the soils that Jesus calls us to be in the constant state of prayer and on guard for a person who's just made a fresh profession of faith. You think that the Father being sovereign and saving a person would just make Jesus not concerned anymore. But in fact, this is when he becomes most concerned. He becomes most passionate about prayer when it comes to issues involving a young believer. The reality is that the immature are the ones who are most vulnerable to this world's folly and are most vulnerable to the attacks of Satan. Jesus was not ignorant to the craftiness and the kinds of subtlety with which Satan always works in the hearts of people. And if you think that Satan is somehow more interested in the children of unbelievers than he is with children who grow up in a family committed to preaching the gospel, then perhaps you've already lost. You perhaps already succumbed to the lie that your voice is somehow louder than the voices of this age simply because you're mom or dad. And so while nowhere in this proverb are we commanded to just sort of hide in the woods or cut ourselves off from the world and become a bunch of monks, it is a call to think wisely about how we ought to be shepherding and counseling each other in this world. to think well about our decisions and who and what voices we let stream into our people's ears and eyes, which according to Matthew chapter 6 is always the pathway to the heart. There is an incredible power in a voice that's not only new and fresh, but also just loud. Especially when it's a voice that speaks and stirs the stuff already residing in the heart of every person, which is sin. It is the voice of our culture and age, and it is a voice which lies in the lap of the evil one. So Solomon says, do not be deceived. Do not be so naive, for the voice of folly, which is just sin, can capture the unguarded heart in a moment. Second, while it is true that fools capture fools by shouting loudly and proudly, nowhere in this proverb is a wise person commanded to then shout even louder. I see this in the news, I see it on Facebook, I see it with people trying to argue with folly. They think that if they can just somehow make a stronger argument or louder argument that they'll somehow win the debate. But the problem, and something that we all must recognize, is that folly at the end of the day is just never an issue of intellect. Rather, folly is always a heart issue. The foolishness is driven in the first instance by a person's passion and desire, never by reason or intellect. One of my old professors, D.A. Carson, who makes his living as a scholar off of always needing to make the better argument, said this, and I'll never forget it. It was a little bit different context, but he said, when the argument is weak and a person's finally backed into their corner, the response of the defeated is to just yell louder. And we know this. In fact, I came across an article entitled, "The Best Way to Win an Argument? Shout louder than everyone else and people will simply assume you're right." The article began by saying, being confident and loud is the best way to win an argument, even if you're wrong, a new study suggests. Researchers from Washington State University drew this conclusion after studying the activity of Twitter users. The more opinionated they were, the more influential and trustworthy they were perceived to be. And the article goes on to give some rather sad case studies. What's important to know is that the mark of wisdom and the mark of a person who actually desires to please God is always a person who's just more interested in helping to mold, shape, and shepherd a heart rather than they are with crushing a heart. So things like Facebook and Twitter set aside, as you speak with your children and interact with your spouse, think about how many times you perhaps just used the bully tactic and just sort of flexed your muscle. In that moment, what was the thing that was driving you, even if you were right? Was it to win the other person to truth and call them to a rightful way of living? Or were you simply desiring to submit them and get them to shut up? Notice in this passage that wisdom is often presented and then received in quiet. Think about even Christ, who after preaching in parables to the crowds, never actually explained the meaning of those parables until he was alone with his disciples. He never shouted at his trial. He never raised his voice in defense. He's described as a sheep at the slaughter, silent before his shears, and even after his resurrection, he still only showed up to a relative few. To the ones whom he desired to actually know truth and were perhaps interested in truth. There's just a kind of grace and dignity, and I would argue even worship, that's absent in bombastity. Now, of course, there's always a time to speak and always a time to stand up for that which is true and right, especially if it's in defense of the defenseless. But the picture all throughout the scriptures, especially in the Proverbs, is that reason and wisdom are never received among bolstering fools, which is actually what you become when you get louder. Now, I'll be the first to admit that sometimes being forceful just produces results. It just gets things done, doesn't it? It shuts the people up and makes them go away. It submits them into doing what you want them to do, but it is not the way of wisdom. And the reason for that is because no amount of submitting a person will ever actually convert or change their heart. In fact, most of the time, it'll harden it. And so Solomon says, well, a person in authority can get their way among a mob of disgruntled fools. It is the wise person whose words are received and then treasured when spoken in quiet. So how do we bring this all together? What are we supposed to take away from a passage that doesn't actually have any commands or imperatives? Well, as you know, Solomon's been asking the question all throughout this book about how certain things in life can be an advantage. And so he's just been asking, what advantage or what gain can something provide a person in their life? And so he's been searching for meaning and purpose and joy. And so while he does offer a lot of counsel, much of his effort has gone into showing that there's actually very little lasting value to anything under the sun. And so you can pursue certain dreams and goals and ambitions, or you can build a nice house and establish a profitable company and make a reputation. But at the end of the day, his less than satisfying but very realistic conclusion has simply been that joy in life and the kind of joy that actually sustains a person comes not from the big achievements in life, but always from the details of life. From the everyday simple things like food and drink and laughter, because as he's been saying, there's no lasting remembrance of anything that any of us are ever going to do. And so he just counseled us to pursue the monotonous things, to pursue the everyday things, because life is short and achievements are fleeting. But beyond that, even when it comes to the issue of wisdom, in trying to see what kind of advantage or gain that wisdom might bring a person, he's just shown over and over again that while wisdom is a worthwhile pursuit, that wisdom is still just better than folly. Still, at the end of the day, like everything else, we must recognize that wisdom has incredible limitations for producing any kind of lasting gain under the sun. In other words, there is no magic formula or way to secure a perpetual state of bliss, no matter how hard you might pursue godly wisdom. And so while I know that this hasn't been a happy sermon at all, it is his observation that we live a life of incredible frustration. The reality of Havel, that is the backwardsness and twistedness and the nature of how this world is not the way that it's supposed to be, is something which constantly presents itself and makes your life difficult. And so while wisdom is going to be Solomon's ultimate answer to everything in chapter 12, which, as he's going to show, is nothing more than simply living out your life with fear and obedience before your creator, the simple reality is that no matter how much righteous living you pursue, none of that will ever guarantee or secure any kind of promise that your life is going to somehow be happier or wealthier or healthier. In fact, as we saw last time, a life of obedience often guarantees much difficulty. in much more hardship than if you were to live a life of pursuing this world. And so when all is said and done, the ultimate meaning and the point of Solomon here is simply to say, your life is hard. It is fraught with difficulty. It's filled with frustrations that are not only sudden, but often unpredictable. But the more that you begin to recognize the world and see it for what it truly is, which is nothing more than an existence absolutely crippled by havel, the more you'll actually begin to realize the value and sustaining nature of godly wisdom, which is going to be the next few chapters. And not only for the pragmatic good that it might produce for you, but also because in the final analysis of both life and death, whether wisdom brings you good or brings you much difficulty, it is at the end of the day still nothing less, if you have eyes to see and a heart to believe, worship. That wisdom pursued and then lived is the kind of life that actually pleases God. And so why in a world of frustrations should we live as a wise man or woman if it cannot promise to alleviate our poverty, enable people to listen, or bring us the honor that we are due? Why not instead, as one man states, just be rich, foolish, loud, honored, and listened to? Because in short, and when all is said and done, and in the grand scheme of eternity, a life of wisdom is still and always a life of worship. And therefore, joy. Wisdom is not this thing designed to simply bring your life a little more pleasure or happiness. In fact, as I said, wisdom will often bring pain and hardship. But if your goal is to be a person committed to truth, a person committed to displaying in all of your capacities the kind of life that brings attention and honor to your Creator, because it's a life that reflects His very attributes and character, then the wisdom of God and therefore obedience to God ought to be the kind of thing that you not only search for, but as the Proverbs say, treasure and live, because it's the pathway to joy. And so in a world of frustrations and a life of havel, it is the wise person who can recognize that expectations just usually fail. That life is laced with difficulty, that frustrations are a reality which will always abound. But it's also the wise person who, in the midst of those experiences, never forgets that we still worship a sovereign God. That He is a sympathetic high priest, aware of your frame, unsurprised by havel, as Psalm 103 states, is aware that you are but dust, and then trusts in the fact that He is a God who knows. He is a God who cares. He is a God who loves. He is one who is deeply interested, not in the first instance with your happiness, but always with your holiness. And that it is through the hardships of life and the frustrations of life that He molds and crafts and shapes all of His people into the image of His Son. And so it is my prayer and hope that we all might trust and believe this truth.